Our next guest, Mac Rollins, goes by Zen Cop Online, runs a brilliant blog and Instagram account related to trauma, law enforcement, and some of the issues related to surviving violence. He's also an amazing holster maker, and he is our guest. We've been talking online for a bit.
Yeah, we have.
I've been following you for a better part of a year. Mm-hmm. We've met each other in person at a training camp pretty recently.
Yeah.
You have a pretty interesting presence online. On my end, I've kind of evolved my presence online. I used to post a lot of cartel videos and a lot of pretty graphic stuff, specifically to try and kind of bring some attention towards kind of the realities of some of the things that I went through and some of the people that I still have a relationship with who are working in Mexico doing the job that I used to do. And then it kind of shifted into mental health on my end. The whole shock and awe factor of kind of showcasing some of those things and the educational side of showing how to do some of the field craft stuff. And then I went through my process of sobriety and trying to figure out my own kind of mental health aspect. And sharing that has been hard. And kind of like expressing some of the aspects of healing and going through sobriety and going from 1 year during COVID doing a bottoms up challenge. I would do these online live videos where I would just fucking down a beer while everybody was shutting during COVID to not drinking. And I'm kind of doing that publicly. It was pretty difficult.
Yeah.
Then I start seeing other people in the community kind of like opening up a little bit more about that, including you. And I think that's when I first started kind of following you. Zen Cop is your title on there, which we immediately kind of like put my attention up. Like I'm pretty into reading about all sorts of Eastern philosophies as well to try and kind of figure out my own ideal, Mac. But can you tell us a little bit about like how you got started in life? You have a pretty wild story all in all, so we're going to kind of ease people into this. But you are currently a California law enforcement professional.
Yes.
Is that, you know, safe to say?
Yeah, I work for a sheriff's office in Northern California.
We kind of started our conversation around grief. I remember online kind of talking a little bit about some aspects of grief. But before we go into all of that, where were you born? Like where you start off your life?
Yeah, I was born in San Jose, California. We lived there for about 5 years. Both my parents were teachers, and I think they just got tired of the environment over there, and we ultimately moved to the...
What was the environment like?
And the area that we lived in, it wasn't great. It wasn't a good part of town, and I think my parents didn't have... There was a lot of family in San Jose for me, and I think it was either my parents or it might have been us first, but we just decided it was too expensive, and I was five when we moved. My brother was a baby. And I think they just wanted to raise us in a different part of town. And at the time, Sacramento was still a city, but the outskirts of it were
rural.
Pretty rural.
Yeah.
There was really nothing out there. I think that's what they were looking for. So they moved out there in around 90, 91. And
you and your two, just you
one,
and your brother?
One brother. He's younger than me, about 3.5 years younger. And both my sons are actually the same, almost... years apart to the day, so it's kind of funny to watch them grow up now. But we moved out there to a pretty small town. There really wasn't anything to it. And my dad got a job working at a high school in South Sacramento, and my mom got a job working for a Montessori school. So when we were younger, they were both teachers. They ultimately went on to become administrators in the same school district and stuff like that. So, you know, growing up, it was I had a really good childhood. I'm very grateful for that. And doing what I do now, I don't think I understood that when I was a kid. I had a very stable home environment.
Yeah.
And my dad would always remind us of that constantly, but it didn't really click when I was a kid.
You have two teachers.
Yeah.
Who that's their whole thing.
Their whole thing is just dealing with kids.
Forming kids. So you have these ninja level people managing your childhood.
Oh, yeah. Managing it to the point to where they even got my grades. Because, you know, when you were a kid, you could get to the mailbox and you could usually get your report card. They got it like an email before I could even get home to sabotage it. So they weren't strict. They were just realistic. And I, we both, my brother and I, had a good upbringing. It was a good childhood, lots of fun memories, and, you know, pretty traditional in that regard. But when we started to sort of experience an odd amount of death, which will kind of tie into what we'll talk about later, but we were introduced to that. My dad's side and my mom's side have an odd number of deaths that have occurred over the years. So
just tragic deaths.
Mostly cancer. So
okay.
Tragic, yeah, but not in the sense of a car accident or something like that, where it was abrupt. They were all very slow. And
so health. I mean, I've experienced kind of both.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing somebody leave suddenly versus seeing somebody waste away.
Yeah.
Slowly.
And that's an odd. It's a comparison that I've never really ever. I could see both sides being equally as terrible, because in what I do now, I get to see both. I get to see the car accident death versus a long hospice case. And it really makes you wonder which one would be worse. And it's its own individual sort of despair, where you have, you know, the car accident where it's an immediate reaction. There's all these horrible things and it's quick.
Yeah.
But the pain comes after, versus a long drawn out type of scenario. The pain comes first and then the death is actually quick. And in a strange way, it usually is a relief.
Yeah.
It's finally over. So it's two very odd.
Yeah. I, on my end, like I went, like I think both of my greatest tragedies were my family, the family members.
For sure.
So like I lost my brother suddenly to an event, which kind of destroyed my family.
Yeah.
And I lost my mother slowly over a bit over a decade.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's like, I don't know. I don't know what's worse on my end. Your family had these, I imagine it was like just cancer related deaths around them.
So it started with my dad's brother. I'm probably going to screw up the ages, but I think I was around 12 when he died. And my dad had three brothers, and his oldest brother got diagnosed with cancer very young. I think he was in his 40s. And they did an amputation of the leg, and it spread. And it was a couple of years, I feel like, before
he passed.
It was
a fight.
Yeah, and it couldn't have happened to all my dad and his brothers. Are just these great men, and I don't have to say that just because of their family. They really are these amazing people that came from a very destructive upbringing, not on their mom's half, but more on their dad's, and just alcohol abuse and all that stuff. So looking at who they were after the fact always just really amazed me, especially my dad. But when he died, like I remember we would go down. We lived in Sacramento. They lived in Sunnyvale, so it's just outside of San Jose. And we would go down on the weekends. Our weekends were usually spent down there anyway, because we were kind of the ones who moved away, so we would always go back and hang out. And I remember going to see him and going into the house, and the staircase, I remember, was just this really steep, long staircase up to the top to the bedroom, and a right turn into the bedroom. And I remember turning and seeing him. I hadn't seen him in a while. And I was a kid, but my reaction was almost like like it really scared me. He looked so sick, close.
The transformation.
Yeah, it was.
Like if people have never been around somebody with like this disease, mm-hmm. it will consume you.
Yeah.
Not just that, but also some of the medicine that gets utilized,
the chemo and
all that, will also, it's like basically your body is trying to destroy itself, and also you're putting more stuff in.
And if you saw him, my dad and his brothers were studs. They were just big, strong dudes. It was just so sad. And
there's no preparation when you're a kid.
No.
Like it's like, hey, we're going to go see your uncle.
Yeah.
And you just walk in there, and
this
big dude is now
this just kind of a shell of a man. It was really sad. And we left, and I think the following weekend, we were at home again, and my uncle, my dad's youngest brother, called him, and I remember him saying, like, hey, it's getting close. You guys should come down. So we were packing up the car in a hurry, and this is back before cell phones, so it was just a landline, and the answering machine caught it. And I remember we were, like, halfway out the door, literally, and my dad just sort of stood there in the frame of the garage and listened to the machine, and the machine said, you know, hey, I don't know if you guys have left yet, but he's gone. And that was the – I saw my dad cry twice. Not that he wasn't afraid to show it, but that was one. And he sort of stood there in the doorway, these big kind of just heaving sobs, and then – my mom hugged him, and we got on the road, and we went to the house.
Who drove?
My dad.
That's a man. That's a man.
Yeah, I mean, my wife can drive. I drive. Yeah. Like, it's just that's. I don't not trust women, but it's just no. I'm driving.
Yeah, but it's still, you know, somebody that just lost somebody like that, and like, yeah, get in the car. I'm gonna drive.
Yeah, I'm driving, and so we drove in pure silence to the house, and I remember they were still kind of collecting the body, and people wanted to say goodbye, and. So that was a very strange introduction to mortality at the age, because for all of us, I mean, and he had two kids, my cousins, and I think they were 12 and 9, I think. So just kind of it was just the worst case scenario. And
the tragedy aspect of what got left behind.
And then it becomes obsessive, because we started to think about mortality and, you know, could this happen to my dad? Could this happen to me, to us? And
like, and you're a kid and you're seeing the tragedy unfolding for your cousins.
Yeah.
And you're like, fuck.
Yeah. And you're trying to kind of put it all together. And at whatever age I was, 12 or 13, that's just, I think it was 11 or 12. That was just a lot to kind of digest. My parents did a good job, but I don't think they understood maybe how much we internalized it and just, you know, worried. And you can ask your kids 1,000 questions that they have to answer it in order for you to understand.
Yeah. Sometimes kids won't be able to answer you because they don't have the words to yet.
I didn't know how to describe what I was feeling.
Yeah.
And then a few years later, my uncle, my dad's youngest brother, his son died at 4 years old of a very, very rare genetic disease. And he died during surgery. And that was another funeral, another just kind of hit to our family, where it was just this really horrible, I mean, a 4 year old. Things
and yeah
that it was
small caskets.
Oh, that, yeah, funny you say that. You can ask my wife. It's like this weird, it was, I think it was white, and it was just, and oddly enough, I don't know why I link it to Pet Cemetery. It's that same where the kid gets hit by the car, same, like, just, oh my god, so terrible.
The visual of a small casket is just like if you want to, you know, if you want to communicate a tragedy to anybody, just the picture of a small casket is pretty, something about that is just devastating.
It's the worst. I mean, if I had to, this is my own take, but in like the kind of the views of death, and this is just my own takeaways, is that you have what I would consider to be like not as bad to the worst possible, and not as bad, I would kind of lump in parents. I know that sounds weird, but our parents are going to die. They should die before us. And that's just kind of how it's an expected death, right? Grandparents, parents, losing them beforehand, obviously, is not ideal.
That's the natural order.
We expect that. After that, I would say, like your brother or sister, losing one of those is horrible, but you know, you'll move on, you'll recover. Behind that, spousal, where you lose your partner. And I think child death is top. Like, it's just the one thing that, no matter at what age it is, it's still like, and I think of my grandma and losing 2 to 4 sons to cancer is like later on, as I became a parent, that became more, real.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the most devastating things that could happen to you as a human being.
Yeah.
I guess I witnessed it through my parents, like when they lost my brother. And my mom went from being an athlete, community organizer, nurse, just this badass woman, to being robbed blind by Christian organizations and going psychiatric.
Yeah.
So I don't know, like I think a lot has been said about it, but It's a corrosive event.
For sure.
It'll consume people. It'll drive people nuts.
Yeah.
If that's no other way kind of saying it, the pain around it. And as a witness to it, you're a kid, I can't imagine how multiple events like that will kind of change you. And also just the... in Mexico, we have a very close relationship to death.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would party at cemeteries when I was a kid. Day of the Dead would come around. We would kiss the bodies of dead relatives when they would be before they got interred and all that stuff. So I wasn't kind of like foreign to death, but it wasn't. It was never that close.
Yeah,
and I think there's, you know, that something changes for you when you're a kid and experience a lot of that.
For sure, it definitely does. I can think about kind of the things I was feeling, and then we had kind of a break in death, kind of. But we would go on to lose, I would lose my cousin to cancer. She was 25-ish. These are my mom's sister's kids. And then my other cousin who died when she was, I think, 30, maybe almost 30. I'm going to get these ages wrong. But even my cousin's daughter who died recently, she was 16, and it's all cancer. So I don't know if we're just completely screwed up or what, but I've done a lot of research into what all these are. There's all different kinds of things that can happen.
Yeah.
Over the years. And my dad died when I was 21 to cancer as well. So it was just this very consistent, like, and I remember as I got older.
It's like this invisible force around you that is just basically just taking people.
Yeah. And then when people started to die internally, we had a homicide that occurred at work where a deputy was killed. And it was so weird because it's all the same shit. And the way that I can put it like into a sentence is once the dust has settled, it's this combination of crying, laughing, and coffee. It's the smell. And that's usually what happens. People sort of gather and people have been awake for a few days. So there's that smell of just kind of stale coffee and people just laughing, sharing memories, and then crying. And that's like the one thing that I've seen just as the years have gone by, just people doing that.
You mentioned these multiple deaths around your family, cousins, aunts. You're 21 when you lose your dad.
Yeah, 21.
And you go through all these, again, they're tragedies. They're sudden. Some of them are, you know, lingering ones. When did you find out about your dad?
So my dad, growing up, I mean, pillar of health. My mom's a hippie and really into yoga and all this other stuff. We ate very healthy. My dad was a healthy guy. He was a big sports guy when he was younger, played college football, and just a really strong, like if you saw a picture of him, he looks like a stud.
Yeah.
And when he was 52, around that time, I remember because most colonoscopies don't get approved insurance-wise until 50. And there wasn't any major issues on his end pathology-wise for the family. His brother's cancer was different. It wasn't something that could have been like a genetic thing. So he finally went in to get his colonoscopy, which most guys put off because they don't want to do it and it's invasive. And just so everyone knows, I've had three, and it's not as bad as you think, and you get to get all doped up and pass out. You wake up, and you get to smash a bunch of food afterward, but it's not that bad. But on that note, when I was 28, 29, I had my first colonoscopy, and there were 6 precancerous polyps removed. So had I not had that, I would have eventually gotten colon cancer.
Yeah.
So if you think it's a possibility, if it's in your family history, just get it done. Doesn't take much. You just have to be a little persistent with the hospital and the insurance stuff. But so I was moved out. I was living in Midtown Sacramento at the time, and my girlfriend at the time, we had an apartment down there, and it wasn't uncommon for me to go home on the weekends and hang out or whatever. I usually went over there and stole food or did laundry or something and went back home. And my dad, he called me. And I remember this wasn't weird. He just said, do you want to do dinner on whatever day? Yeah, sure. And he said, come over around this time. Cool. And so I go over to the house, and I was by myself. I didn't bring my girlfriend. And I remember he's like, yeah, let me talk to you for a second. And we went over to the dining room table, which is separate from the kitchen. And that table was usually for like holidays or if we were in trouble or something was gonna, we're gonna have a talking to. And I remember thinking, whatever this is, I'm an adult, obviously I can't get in trouble anymore. And we were sitting there and he said, I just wanna let you know that I went to the doctor and they, I had my colonoscopy and I didn't know what that was. What's a colonoscopy? He goes, well, it's when they shove a camera up your ass and they look for cancer. I said, oh, how was that? He goes, well, not good because they found something. And I said, okay, do we know much about it? He's like, no. He's like, I just know that it's cancer and they're going to do some tests and we'll figure it out. And I said, okay. And I remember what he said. He said, I'm going to be okay. And I remember just going like, yeah, of course you are. You're my dad. You're going to be fine. And that was kind of it. It was a very just like my dad was a very kind of straight shooter guy. And to this day, I still think my mom tells me this all the time. I really think that he was just like, no, fuck that. I'm going to beat it. Like I can beat it. I'll figure it out. And, you know, no big deal. Doesn't want to freak us out. And so I go home and I remember I walk in the door and I was kind of like, my dad has cancer. And she was like, what? And I said, yeah, it's colon cancer. I don't know if that's bad or what. And this is before smartphones. I still had a flip phone. So I had to hop online and like Google. And if you really want to freak yourself out, Google cancer shit. And so I Google it. And, you know, if you don't know or understand, it's very hard to read the percentages and likelihood of survival. It's like within this much time percentages within 5 years. Does that mean he lives 5 years and he's good or does he die in five? So I just kind of got lost in the shuffle. And my dad called me maybe a week later and he's like, yeah, it's stage four. So that's bad. And I was like, okay, that's bad. And they started doing chemo. This all happened in 1 year. So it got discovered and he was dead within a year, maybe a year and change. And so the doctors recommended doing chemo. They did two surgeries. Both surgeries, I think, made it worse. I mean, it's a game. It's kind of just like a roll of the dice to see what's going to work and won't. And the big thing with colon cancer is if it's aggressive and has it spread. And so I think they figured out pretty quickly that it was spreading. And towards the end, I want to say it was attacking his liver, his lungs. So it was just all bad. And I remember just, I would go home and he would look different within, I wouldn't see him for 7 days and he would just look physically different. And
he's getting consumed.
Yeah. And my uncle, his brother is a doctor. And I remember him pulling me aside and he said, and he didn't mean it like in a bad way. I could tell what he was. Now I know what he was saying. He said, you got to spend more time with your dad. And I remember thinking like, okay. Like he's telling me this is not get going ready. Well, yeah.
And get ready.
And so within a few months, he just deteriorated. He made jokes that he was back to his high school weight, but he didn't look good. Like it was just so thin and emaciated. But that was him, just like a positive attitude the whole time. He was a very hard man to, like, you couldn't say or do anything to really get under his skin. He just was the nicest guy. Very resilient.
Are you in denial across all of this, basically?
Yeah, I mean, like denial
of the aspect, like it's not that bad.
Yeah, like it's not bad, and it's funny because I remember thinking like I should quit my job, I should move back home, and my dad would have said absolutely not, like no, you're not doing that, and he would have been right. But at the same time, I don't live with regrets. I really try not to, but the one regret that I have is probably not spending more time with him.
Yeah, after losing somebody like that, mm-hmm. you think back on it. There would never be enough time to kind of fill that.
No, never. Even now, like, I would do anything for 5 minutes, but in that 5 minutes, what would I really accomplish? I don't know. I don't know if I'd be able to even have, like, a rational thought.
Yeah.
In my dreams, it's weird because I don't care. Like, in my dreams, we'll talk, and I'm just like, hi, and it's like, hey.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so weird to have those dreams and be so nonchalant about it, but
I wanted to take this opportunity to thank each and every one of our Patreon members for their generous support. It's the only way we can bring some of these amazing people behind the microphone and have some of these amazing Midnight of the Soul conversations for you guys. If you're not already a part of the Patreon community, please consider joining us. We have our giant online training catalog for you guys to have access to, as well as some exclusive Sneak Reaper Industries merch drops for you guys at the Dead Drop tier. I would also like to thank the company Sneak Reaper Industries, one of our main supporters and a company that provides some of the most amazing urban wear, survival specific, and cutlery out there. Your support not only makes this show possible, but also supports some of the charities that we run, including the Fighter's Kitchen out of Puerto Escondido, where we're supporting some up-and-coming fighters under the tutelage of Eddie Farrell. Thank you for your support, and again, please consider joining us on the Patreon. And now back to the show.
It's, I have a shit ton of regrets. for me, you know, thinking back on specifically about my mom. My mom was psychiatric for the last few years that she was with us.
Yeah.
So I could never, even if I wanted to, have some of the conversations that I wanted to have with her.
Psychiatric, like she just wasn't.
She was erratic. And I can, every now and then she would have these moments of lucidity. She had one the day before she left us.
Yeah.
She had this full day of lucidity. She, like, I don't know where, said, hey, like, I would stay with her and my dad, because she would leave. She would try to escape the house. Yeah. And just wander. She did that a few times. The last day that she was with us, she asked to take some pictures with my kid. Because she said, hey, I don't have a lot of pictures where it's me and your daughter. Like, mm-hmm. Can we take some pictures? And I said, yeah, you know, let's do that. She bought her a little white dress, and she took her in the backyard. And her whole thing was that she wanted to take some pictures with her and have some where it was just my daughter.
Yep.
Right? So she was, like, directing her. And I remember that afternoon just kind of looking at the pictures and kind of like, you know, it was great. And I had my mom there for a moment. And I just expressed to her, because she would not take her medication. She would hide it and stuff like that. I was just like, hey, mom, like, you feel great right now. Yeah, it's because you've been taking your medication. Just please do that for us, for all of us. You're doing great. And she says, I'm trying, but I can't control it sometimes, she said. It feels like I'm in a car and I can't move the steering wheel.
Hmm.
And I've been there myself before. Like, I know what that meant.
Yeah, it's a good analogy.
She says, like, it's like I'm in a car, but I can't work the brakes and I can't work the steering wheel.
Just going. Like,
and it's not, I'm not doing it on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that pain in her eyes where she was like, it's like she wasn't in control.
Yeah.
You know? And she left the next day. And when I have dreams about her, like when I'm trying to talk to her, it's always I never like, I have 1,000 things I want to say, but it's always like, hey, what's
yeah, like you're seeing a cup of coffee. Like,
yeah.
Like you talked an hour ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's strange. You know, I was like, I have that, unresolved feeling around her and that loss, because I was also in a denial state. Mm-hmm. Like, I had, you know, and also I just never had any grief counseling or any tools around losing anybody. Mm-hmm. And at this point I'd lost many, many people, like, close to me. You have this experience with your father of, you know, having lost a lot of family members, and now you lose him. Like, are you aimed at anything specific as far as your life and what you're going to do with it? Or is this nebulous? Are you nebulous as shit when that happens?
That was the hard part, because I didn't really understand it. At the time, I was kind of just like, I'm not sure what I'm going to do. I had a motorcycle. I thought I was pretty cool and just working and I'll figure out. My dad was always very like, what are you going to do for a career? And my dad was very sports oriented, very into, you know, he He was a good student. I wasn't a terrible student, but I wasn't great. And skateboarding was more important than anything, including my future and everything else. So
was that your deal? Skateboarding?
Yeah, skateboarding was everything. And my dad, he would always support what I did, which was so cool. If I wanted to do whatever, he would let us try it. If we liked it, great. He never would like, okay, you guys got to do this. And he was probably a little bummed out that we didn't play football, but you know, it's fine. He genuinely supported whatever we did. And I remember being 21 and still kind of, I had an idea of what I wanted to do, but I wasn't locked into anything. And as my dad would, I could tell towards the end, he was like, so like, what do you want? And he would tell me like, you have so much potential, but you're just kind of here. And looking back on it now and having kids, I could totally see how he was just like stressing, like, you got to do something. And in theory, my brother was going to Cal Poly for biomedical engineering. And I was just like, yeah, school's dumb. And so he's kind of like, yeah, like, let's get a plan. And I was doing, I had some interest. I got my EMT. I was working at a hospital. Just kind of, that was my interest initially, was kind of like the emergency medicine stuff. I had no desire to be a firefighter, despite the mustache, which I brought back recently. People are a lot, when they know, they think I'm a firefighter, I get treated a lot better. Just kidding.
I mean, you don't have to worry about anybody spitting in your food, yeah. You know?
So I was kind of just dancing around a bunch of stuff, and I know that gave him a lot of anxiety. And when he actually died, if you want to talk about, you referenced the spider bite earlier with Spider-Man. For life, that was the bite for me.
The origin point, mm-hmm. like when things, you know, I don't know what to call, like, I say a spider bite because that's like,
it's a great
Spider-Man got bitten by this random radioactive spider. Mm-hmm. But there's in the lives of many of the people that have been sitting right where you are, like everybody that's been on here, there's always a moment or an event that is like lightning, like getting struck by lightning. Or, you know, we had a guy here who was blown up by an IED. Somebody else was almost murdered. These moments of the world ending in a lot of ways around them. Every now and then people are like, hey, what if the world ends? Like, for who? Like, you know, if tomorrow the U.S. collapses, the world isn't going to end for other people, maybe for Americans. But apocalypses can be personal what I figured out for myself. And, you know, people that go through their own personal apocalypse either, you know, stay there and just kind of go the path of like, well, let's see where I go from here to transformation. You know, this whole like challenge to transform and to change. So you decided to do what with that?
Well, the night he died was very interesting. And granted, we had all this experience with death, but this is my first rodeo for something that's
close,
attached to me.
Yeah.
And my mom called me and she said, hey, I think we're getting, and this has been going on for maybe a week now, where it's just progressively getting worse. He's non-responsive. He's just sort of, they had moved him down. He was on hospice at this point. And she called me and she said, I just feel like it's getting really close. You should probably come down. And so my girlfriend at the time and I jump in the car, go down there. And she says, yeah, I just wanted you guys to be able to say goodbye. I've already talked to him. You guys can go ahead. And my girlfriend went in there. They were pretty tight, my girlfriend and my dad at the time. And she said goodbye. My brother went in and said goodbye. And then it was my turn. And I remember walking in the room and just sort of staring for a long time. And his breathing was super shallow, long pauses. And just like, I went and sat next to him and I talked to him for a while. I can't remember exactly what I said, but I know I told him that I'd take care of the family and my brother and my mom and all this stuff. And that I remember saying specifically, like, I'm going to figure my shit out. Like, don't worry. Like, it'll happen. And, you know, all that stuff. And I walked out of the room and, we had this, this is when computers still had like an area in the house. Nowadays it's just laptops, but we had like this computer area with this desk and the computer that we used for basically homework and porn when we were younger. But that's another story we can talk about later. But I was sitting there, and my brother and my girlfriend were just kind of sitting in chairs in the same room. It's like this room next to the dining room. And I was on, it was something involving music, I can't remember. But in the movie The Matrix, this is the only way I can really explain it. They have that hole in the back of their, yeah, the plug. And there's this big thing that goes in the plug that goes into their brain. I felt my dad die. And the feeling was something being ripped out of the back of my head. I felt, I actually said, like, I sat up and I said, "Dad's dead." And my brother goes, "What?" And I said, he's gone. And he's like, "How do you know?" I said, "I just know." And I got up and I walked in the bedroom and I stood there for what felt like forever, just waiting for him to breathe. And I walked over to him, and it's funny because I didn't check for a pulse. I didn't do anything like that. I put my ear to his chest, which was so juvenile and such an odd thing to do. I didn't hear a heartbeat. And I walked back out to the living room and I said, "Yeah, he's gone." And my brother says, "Go tell mom." I said, "Fuck you, you go tell mom." And he's just like, "No." I'm like, "I don't want to do it." And I'm like, "Well, I'm the oldest. I can do it." And she was upstairs. She went and took a shower. And I walked upstairs and she was kind of just standing there in her bathrobe. And I said, "Hey," I said, "sorry, Dad's dead." And it was so strange because I expected a reaction. I didn't expect this reaction that I got, because she just sort of collapsed into my arms and started just crying. And not that that's not a normal reaction, but it was just one of those things where I was like, it's like I just told you something extremely tragic, but that's when her tragedy hit. I don't know if she just wasn't, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But I held her for what felt like forever and set her on the bed. And then I remember just going downstairs and grabbing the phone book with all our family and just start, this was late. It was like midnight. Calling people and sort of just waking people up, and family started showing up, and my grandma showed up, and I'll never forget this fucking noise she made when she walked into the kind of the entryway, and I think she asked, like, "Is he really gone?" I mean, she knew he was gone. He said yes, and she just let out this, like,
a wail.
Yeah, it was very primal and just so sad. And
Women have their own way of expressing grief, I guess. And I've in my life experiencing mothers arriving to see their children.
Same.
It's always this wail that you can put up all the arms to try and stop them from running over to see their kids or from try and calm them down, but they are, it's like trying to put a storm in a jar. There's no way.
You can't, yeah.
There's no way. And also, like, you want to talk about, like, I've faced some pretty scary people in my life. Nothing intimidated me more than a mother going through a grief tragedy, explosive grief tragedy like that. I just, what do you do?
That's, I still don't like them. I'm good at them. I don't mind doing them, but doing a death notification is one of the most horrific things you can ever do.
And it'll keep you.
Oh yeah, those. If you wanted to talk about like, "Hey, you're a cop. What fucked you up the most?" I'd be like, probably those.
Yeah, probably death notifications.
Probably those. Like, just what do you do?
And also, this for me, it's like some of death notifications when I was young and I didn't have any experience
doing how you presented it, how you talked,
and I didn't have anybody telling. Like, the older guys just said, like, "Hey, you do it."
Yeah.
and
go, new guy, go fucking ruin this person's life. Yeah, and hopefully you do it right.
Yeah. What changes for you then? I mean, you were kind of aimless when this tragedy happened, and now you're
everything's kind of subjective, or I guess dispositional, where you are. And oddly enough, my brother, who's sober right now, but he was an alcoholic for a long time. There's different, my mom, to everyone. Everyone's going to have their own, I guess, takeaway from what happened. For me, I kind of just had to start growing up and
yeah.
like, I had my own place. I was working, but I needed to like do more. I needed to kind of man up and be there and be responsible. And, it just sort of made me, I got a better job. Then I started thinking about career stuff and what I wanted to do. And law enforcement eventually came along, but within that period, my relationship sort of fell apart with the girlfriend I had at the time. If I'm being completely honest, I think she probably stuck around longer than she should have because of my dad. So that fell apart. That was another huge, just like,
yeah,
it just kept one thing after another.
When you think you're hitting bottom, it's like, yeah, oh, no, it's a third floor. Yeah. There's still a few more to go.
And nothing against her. I wasn't the greatest person at the time either. So I'm sure I had my issues and I was probably an asshole. And I, to this day, I mean, I wouldn't change anything I did, even if it was bad, because it brought me to where I am now. And I wouldn't change anything for the world. I like where I am now. And a couple years later, I ended up getting together with my wife. And then here we are 14 years later with two kids. And then we had a kid before we got married, so we did it backwards. But literally, I was just kind of like one thing after another that I had to just sort of, okay, great, now this is happening. And then now I'm going to be a dad. And that just sort of changed everything. And I eventually went into the academy and, you know, here we are. But
what pushed you into law enforcement out of all things?
So,
like, you're growing up skateboarding, you said. Imagine you're into the music and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what are you into as far as music growing up?
Oh, from a very young age, music. So I can go back to the living room. My parents had this just huge. My dad was really into music. My mom was too, but not necessarily my speed of music. But these just records. I would just look at these records. I remember as a kid just kind of picking random ones and listening and
But I mean, the whole aspect of fuck the police.
Well, that never really came up. Like, I always had kind of like a, I never hated the cops, even as a skateboarder. Like, most of the cops, though, were so cool. It was county at the time, and they were chill. They didn't give a shit.
Not here.
Not up here? No.
Not here. No, fuck
the police. I was lucky. They were cool. They'd like be like, all right, you get two more attempts, and then you're done, man.
Yeah.
But they were chill. I never really had a problem with authority. And even in the music scene, which my dad also was like, again, really supportive of like what I was into. And I remember I took him to go see Anti-Flag in, I think I was like in sophomore year. And my dad went with us. He's like, yeah, I'll go, whatever. And he sat through the whole show and he drove all of us back and he's just like laughing. And we're like, what? And he goes, like, we're talking about all the cool stuff they had. And he goes, you know, it's a tax write-off for them, right? And we were like, what's a tax write-off? And he tells us and he's like, all this fuck the system bullshit. These guys are... whatever, you guys will understand someday. And we're like, no, we won't. Like, we won't conform.
You don't know.
You don't understand.
But
music stuff, what really sort of got my attention when I was a kid, the town we lived in was super small. And there was a video store, the one, this is before Blockbuster or Hollywood. And they had this like dirt bike video. It was called Krusty, Demons of the Dirt.
Okay, yeah.
And I think his name was Seth Enslow. I think I wasn't a motocross guy, but it was just what we got. And the song that came on, I remember I was just like, what the hell is this? This is insane. And I was probably in fifth or sixth grade at the time. And back in the day, you used to have to go to the credits to see what song was what. So I go to the credits and I see White Zombie Supercharger Heaven. And I go, cool, yeah. We're going to Tower Records this weekend. And so I spin it to my mom, like, hey, I'm going to the music store. She's like, yeah, yeah. And this is when parental advisory labels were.
Yeah, they started showing up.
Yes.
This is like the mid-90s, right?
This is probably 95, 96.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I remember seeing them like on the Marilyn Manson.
Yes, it was on everything.
Holy shit.
And if it was on there, you couldn't buy it. And so we go to the record store. I'm just like, she's like, what are you looking for? I was like, oh, I don't know, nothing in particular. And I go, find it. And I see the album cover. I go, fuck, like this has got like tits on it and swear words and it's all satanic. And there's no fucking way I'm going to buy this thing. So I was like, did you find what you want? Like, no. And so we started to get smart and we would record stuff on the radio. Like it would be edited, but you could hit record. And that's when music became an interest. And then I would say after that, what was really cool about that though is it eventually became Rob Zombie. And in seventh grade, I asked my dad, I said, I really want to go to this concert. Can you take me? And he's like, okay, what is it? I said, well, it's Rob Zombie and Korn. It's a Family Values tour.
Dude.
And he's like,
I remember Family Values. Like, sure. I remember that era.
Yeah, we can go.
It's Dracula era, right?
Yeah, it was Dracula. That album had dropped, and Korn was the headliner, oddly enough. Zombie opened, and there was a band, I think, called Videodrome that was the first opener. But it was on a weekday, and I came home from school, put on whatever I was going to wear. My dad comes home from work, and he's a teacher at the time. And all he does is take off his tie. Doesn't change. He still wears his Dockers and his tucked in shirt. And we hit the road. We got some food and we get to the parking lot. And my dad, like, he's not a stranger to concerts. He went to all kinds of concerts when he was younger. You know, he's used to the tailgating and the, you know, but this was a new style and just lots of just like white zombie fans and a lot of
JNCO jeans.
Yeah.
And
lots of satanic shit, weed, chains, and just like
chain wallets.
Oh, yeah. All of it.
And so spikes.
Yeah, the whole nine.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like, it's not a culture shock because he's a high school teacher. So he didn't really have a problem with that. What got interesting is people started to recognize him from school. And they were like, oh, Mr. Mack, you're here. Like, oh, how's it going? And he's like, good. Like, oh, we didn't know you liked this band. And we go and we get our seats, and they're decent seats. I was really excited. The opener starts, Rob Zombie starts, and it's just nothing but Charles Manson on like the Jumbotron. And my dad was like from the Mansonoid, you know, his childhood and stuff or teenage years or whatever. And he was just like, that's Charles Manson. And I was like, I don't know who that is. He goes, it's a very bad person. And I was like, okay, like, I don't, like, don't make us leave. Like, we'll get through it. And they finish. And I remember the guy next to us was smoking a joint and he passes it to my dad. And I'll never forget this. My dad said, no, thanks. I'm trying to cut back. And the guy's like, cool. And just keep smoking. And I'm like, oh, my God, I can't believe we're still here. And Korn gets on stage, and it was really, really badass. But they brought all these, like, girls from the audience to the stage. And the theme was, like, this big – it was like a jail cell. So they couldn't get on the stage, but they could watch. And they had the camera guy down there. So all this stuff was, like, on the big Jumbotron thing. And this girl takes her shirt off and wraps her tits around one of the bars and starts, like, titty fucking it. And I remember I just kind of sat there, like, and my dad kind of looked over. He's like, I guess you're a man now, Jesus Christ. And we left, and he told me that was the last concert we would go to.
Solid.
I was like, cool, but we got through it.
As long as he went through the whole thing, it's
fine. As soon as they were done, his ass was out of his seat. Let's go. Come on, we got to beat the traffic. And it was fun. I will always be grateful for that experience. But after that, he's like, I remember he went home and was like, we need to pump the brakes. Like, this is.
Yeah, let's do it.
What are you listening to? And I would, like, show him and. He was understanding because most of his music was, I mean, focused around like drugs and stuff. So it's just,
I mean, I grew up in the same era. You know, Korn was singing about angst, sexual abuse, drug use. Every day I think about sex. You know, Dracula was singing about horror movies.
Yeah.
Rob Zombie is all about. I would see them and I would be like, hey, Abby who's here. Who does the podcast? Produces the podcast. Abby is a cinephile, and he traumatized me from a very young age by just showing me a bunch of horrible movies, like from old to new. So whenever I would see Rob Zombie shit, I was like, "Yeah, that guy just watched too many fucking B movies."
He's
an artist, but this is what it's about. But there's a, I mean, it's what's shocking now as far as like music. Like you see music now. I mean, I don't know, you see this lady, Ice Spice, show up on stage wearing what she wears, which is great. You know, I get it. But the whole shock and awe factor now is kind of more orientated to the sexuality.
Very sexual.
Yeah. And like being promiscuous and all that shit, which is, you know, it's always been there in a lot of ways. But now it's a very more kind of like specifically orientated to a very young crowd.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, just having the experience of being a kid and seeing what your parents are shocked about what you're listening to. I remember listening to The Exploited and just hearing them just fucking scream about hating cop cars.
Yeah.
And my dad was like, what are they singing about? My dad doesn't know how to speak English or like understand. Like, what is he singing about?
Don't worry. Politics. Like,
they're angry about the government. Yeah. Yeah, it was just fascinating to see how it's changed now, like what's shocking now.
Yeah, music's different entirely. I feel like there's not a lot of art attached to it and more shock. And back when we were younger, you know, you could hear a song and, you know, you'd want to read the lyrics. You'd open up a little pamphlet. And if you were a true fan, you'd read it and kind of, okay, that's kind of neat and whatever. And it just sort of depended on the genre. But, I mean, even for our parents, you know, the Black Sabbath was considered like really evil music. The Beatles was considered satanic.
Yeah, look at their hair. Look at their hair.
It is kind of funny, but that the music scene, I'll never forget it because it really was like, it went hand in hand with skateboarding, but it was a safe place for kids to be. And the scene, like our parents, so Rob Zombie and Korn was kind of different because that was, I would call that like mainstream.
Yeah, that was like way mainstream back
and,
then.
And when I was a kid, the first CD I ever got was Offspring Smash. And that was, I think, like sixth grade. And that got me into Nitro Records. And so I started getting into punk. And then punk ultimately evolved into like hardcore and death metal. And in Sacramento, there's a really cool venue called West Coast Worldwide. It's four times the size as this with the same ceiling. It's not a huge place. It looks more like what used to be a business. And there's a band called The Hoods, and they're from Sacramento. And Mikey, who I haven't seen in a long, long time, was just kind of like this patron saint of hardcore. And we would, once our parents figured out, so I was also straight edge when I was in high school, which helped trust for my parents because I explained what it was and rolled with it. And I was straight edge for most of my adolescence. And we would go to these shows. And I remember my dad like went to drop us off once, but we were also driving too, but he just wanted to see where we were. And I remember like Mikey came out, introduced himself and, hey, how's it going? Cool. And this is who's playing. And it was really chill. Like there were some assholes and weirdos there, but the scene itself was so welcoming. And you could see the same thing for like the skateboarding scene, the bodybuilding scene, the motorcycle, all these things that appear to be this very coarse, rough, but they're the nicest people.
Once you're past that door.
Yeah. And the hardcore scene was the same way. And, you know, there were some, just I guess, people who were not that way, but the majority of them were just so welcoming.
So you take all this experience just growing up like with great parents, some of the tragedy around that, the cultural influence of growing up in that scene, and then you're at the doorsteps of the academy.
Yeah. Odd man out for sure. Like in this career field, I think I've met, when I say guys like me, like upbringing music, it's a small handful. And one of my best friends, he works at a different office where I work, but I didn't know him very well, and we didn't really know each other. And one day the snow was so bad, I couldn't park my car. This is at the old range we used to have. And it was pretty out there in the sticks. And he had a truck. I had a Honda Accord at the time, and he pulled up. You need a ride? I was like, yeah, sure. I get in his car, and on the dashboard is this like a army man, that size, but it's Satan. And I said, what is that? He goes, oh, that's Satan. I said, neat. And he's kind of looking at me, and we go park, and just kind of, if you don't know him, he's a man of very few words until you get to know him. And when we were done at the range, I said, you know, what kind of music do you listen to? And he says, oh, I listen to metal. And I said, what kind? And that's when he just kind of stopped and looked at me. He said, give me your phone. And he opens up my iTunes, and we have been best friends ever since, because so rare to find someone. And then, of course, we like, oh, have you heard this band? And in my entire office, there's only a few of us who really like that music.
It's outlying shit. Like, people that usually end up in that career, that's usually not their background.